2,100 local governments in 39 countries have made climate declarations. This allows the government to take emergency action to reverse global warming. These actions could include natural resource rationing, prohibit development, and in severe cases, mandatory lockdowns. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to look at the dramatic steps governments are threatening to take in the name of saving the planet. Let's get started. Ever since COVID, there has been a lot of fear about another round of lockdowns. But this time, it is not for the virus, but for the environment. We're going to bring in our international correspondent, Roxana Solano, to break down what happened to the planet the last time the world stood still. Roxana.
Scotty, it was only 3 years ago when the whole world was ordered to stay home to prevent the spread of COVID. What we all thought was for only 2 weeks turned into 2 years. While this destroyed economies and bankrupted businesses, it was actually good for the environment. Many people were working from home, which means they were no longer driving in their cars. Less cars on the road means less pollution in the air. Airlines couldn't fill the planes, and some with only one passenger were grounded and canceled, meaning less fuel emissions. Cruises were all docked. Cruise lines have been a target of environmentalists for tripling the size of your carbon footprint the moment you step on deck, compared to other typical vacations. People cheered they were no longer dumping waste into the oceans. Beachgoers were seeing dolphins closer to shores, and waters had never been so clear. Even trains and buses for public transit were halted completely or reduced their service. For instance, here in Washington, D.C., many bus routes were canceled and the metro went from running every 2 to 3 minutes to running every 30 minutes. Even now, as we're returning from the pandemic, the trains only run every 15 minutes. With fewer people walking the streets, New York and San Francisco, usually full of people, were nearly empty. This also led to less litter on the ground. Here in Washington, D.C., again, we saw grass grow in areas usually filled with foot traffic. It seemed almost as if cities turned greener. National parks shut down to visitors now had wildlife sunbathing in the middle of the road, coming out and exploring areas they had never dared to before due to mass crowds. Many businesses are implementing work from home permanently. This leads to less need for building infrastructure to handle rising commuters' population, meaning less trees have to be torn down to widen roads. But as the world came out of lockdown and began to return to work, traveling and our everyday lives so came back to pollution. Now the UN is warning against the chance to combat climate change is a, quote, rapidly closing window. It seems we were worse than we started. But even back in the height of the pandemic, when the world was so supposedly much healthier environmentally, the UN was saying countries were not on track to meet the Paris Agreement's climate goals. And we have to remember, with all these ground flights also came mass layoffs. With canceled bus routes, low-income workers had no way to get to their jobs. Restaurant workers and other customer service industries who cannot work from home became dependent on governments. And stimulus handouts have led to record inflation and an impending recession. We're also now learning COVID was a lie. It isn't as deadly as we first believed. The vaccines don't work, and governments are now releasing findings the virus came from a lab leak in Wuhan. The mask everyone was forced to wear, new studies say they didn't even stop the spread. Now account for 5,500 tons of plastic waste as 1.6 billion disposable masks enter our oceans since 2020. People have lost faith in their governments and media for making them stay home and destroying the economy and lives of low and middle class families across the globe. Would people even trust scientists if they said a lockdown would save the planet? So while a lockdown may have helped Mother Earth for just a moment, at what cost did we have to pay? And what would be the price to do it again? I'm Roxana Solano for 360 View. Back to you, Scotty.
Wow, Roxana. I mean, I'm not old enough that I remember what those lockdowns did just for our industry, much less others. But we knew that we could come back out if there were certain benchmarks reached. With climate change, it's not like there would be those benchmarks that would be permanent. As we've already seen, we're already back to where we were pre-pandemic standards, according to climate change activists.
Would you be willing to stay home again to save the planet, Scotty?
I think it actually might hurt the planet if I stay home. I have teenagers. Thank you, Roxana, for the story. Joining me to shed light on this subject is Carly Matthews, Communications Director at the American Conservation Coalition. Thank you so much for joining me, Carly.
Thanks for having me, Scotty.
So the United Nations is warning the window to take action against climate change is, quote, rapidly closing. Now, the report details the possible risk of premature deaths across the globe due to climate change. What could cause a death from climate change as you see it?
Right, so it's a good question. And I think that the biggest issue that we're dealing with here is kind of the idea of alarmism ruling the conversation when we're talking about climate change. It's not helpful to tell people that they're going to die in 10 years. It's not helpful to tell them that we're out of time to take action. I think there are environmental effects that we should be careful of, air quality, of course, increased temperatures, extreme weather. Those are serious concerns, but I don't think it's really successful. I don't think it's rational to be telling people that climate change means they're going to die and there's nothing we can really do about it.
Yeah, fear is something that is used often, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the most effective way of getting people to understand what is actually going on. So what do you say to those climate skeptics out there? And furthermore, why should the average citizen trust scientists on this one, considering the past history from the past few years?
Right. So I think that's a great point. I think that we've seen kind of a general increase of distrust of all institutions really across the board, whether they be political, scientific. In fact, Nature magazine, which is a really up until recently very respected scientific journal, found that after it endorsed Joe Biden in 2020, people started to distrust it. And they actually distrusted their scientific expertise because they weighed in on politics. So I think that we're seeing overall kind of a distrust in institutions. But when I talk to climate skeptics, when I talk to folks who aren't sure about whether or not climate change is happening or whether or not we should care, frankly, I start with the idea that we all want clean air and clean water. We all want a healthy planet to live on. And we should be taking steps to make sure that we have that today, but also for future generations. And I think that that's really successful, kind of igniting this conservation ethos, talking about, our shared experiences in nature, why our planet matters. I think that that's a really good gateway. And then we can get into, the more granular solutions to decarbonizing or to the effects that we're seeing from climate change.
When you're talking to those skeptics, and I have to ask this based on your last answer, when you're talking to those skeptics, do you see a difference from one political side, maybe more liberal versus conservative, or even age, is the older versus the younger generation? Who do you feel like is most accepting that something needs to be done or most accepting that there are changes happening?
Sure. Yeah, I think this is absolutely an age gap rather than a political gap. And you'll see that young conservatives compared to young progressives both have pretty high levels of, thinking climate change is real, wanting to support politicians who think climate change is real. So I really do think it's a generational gap rather than a partisan gap. Although I will say that, as conservatives get older blocks of voters in conservatives, they tend to be the more skeptical, which I think is fair. I think we've seen, climate activists be wrong. I think we can point back to Al Gore or, some of that kind of early 21st century climate messaging that frankly just didn't come to pass. But I do think that coming back to this idea of, wanting to steward our planet, wanting it to be better for all generations, I think that that's something that really unites folks across ages, across partisanship, across geography even.
Well, then you go to the extreme because we are hearing these whispers about climate lockdowns. We hear that lockdowns may have made the planet healthier during COVID, But what is the reality of this happening now? You know, we've seen protests in Hong Kong when China tried to lock down for their zero COVID policy, and the world actually rallied behind them. What are the chances people would be actually susceptible to accepting a lockdown for the environment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we did see, you know, kind of an environmental rebound during the beginnings of COVID lockdowns. People were pointing to the rivers in Venice and, you know, fish returned. They looked cleaner. But I guess my question to that would be, at what cost, right? And when we're talking about climate or environmental solutions, they should be good for people and good for the planet. And I don't think that a lockdown is good for people. So when we're talking about, you know, combating climate change or protecting our environment in general, I think we have to be realistic about the trade-offs. And lockdowns, frankly, have too high of trade-offs. I don't think it's worth it for humans. I don't think it's worth it for society.
It just seems very dramatic considering the stage that we're in right now and where we're coming back from. You know, I want to get your take on this gas stove debate that has just recently erupted. Hot topic right now. In America, 40% of households do have a gas stove. Other countries, that ratio is even higher. California passed this no new construction will have a gas stove. New York, the city of New York did the same. How will people cook when the electric company cuts their power due to high wind during the season? You know, I keep thinking about to the Biden administration attempting to push legislation banning these gas stoves has caused an uproar. I would love your take on the gas stove ban, and if this is really, once again, just like the lockdowns, is this really a dramatic step that would have that much of an impact on the environment and would be accepting by people?
It's a great question, and I think it's been really interesting how the Biden administration has tried to kind of navigate this discourse, because at first, you know, it was kind of a flub from an administration official saying that they might consider doing this. And then we were told, oh, no, we're not doing that. You know, that's crazy. That's just conservatives pouncing. But to your point, there are states and localities who are banning new gas construction, basically meaning when you construct a new building, it wouldn't have the gas hookups that you'd need to put a gas stove in those residences. So I think that, first of all, it's an ineffective climate policy, right? A lot of people are pointing to a study where, you know, having a gas stove in your home causes childhood asthma or really dramatically decreases the quality of the air in your home. But frankly, it's just a really negligible difference if you have an electric stove or a gas stove. Interestingly, actually, it's more dangerous for air quality to cook with olive oil than to cook with a gas stove. But again, both are really negligible effects on your health. So I think we're getting distracted with these like bans or top-down solutions rather than just focusing on innovating and letting the private sector take the lead on climate solutions, letting localities really do what works best for them. And I think with the gas stove ban, it's really just an example of government overreach that won't have that much of an effect.
Thank you so much, Carly Matthews. Now, stick around with us for the second part of the show, because as governments are placing more climate mandates on companies, we see if there is any sort of middle ground to saving the environment. I'm Skynell Hughes, and you are watching 360 View.
Since the beginning of its history, the United States of America has officially declared the striving for freedom and people's right to happiness. However, in reality, having won independence, American colonists headed for the total extermination of the indigenous population of the continent. American Indians were deprived of their land. Local residents were driven into reservations and given the worst agricultural territories, while the best land was appropriated by white colonizers. The strongest blow to American Indian tribes was the extermination of bison. Native Americans lived by hunting these wild animals. Colonists slaughtered the bison and, in fact, made them nearly extinct. "Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone," said Colonel Richard Dodge. a veteran of the bloody and vicious Indian Wars, cynically. The indigenous population was simply exterminated. U.S. Army General Philip Sheridan expressed the essence of this policy in the infamous words, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." The genocide of Native Americans of North America led to a demographic catastrophe. The exact number of deaths is still unknown, but the number of victims is in millions. Having been the majority on the continent before, the indigenous people make up less than 3% of the U.S. population today.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Когда ты выходишь, и, честно говоря, аж волосы шевелятся дыбом, потому что столько мусора. И вот бочки, миллионы бочек. В общем, когда половодье, естественно, это все поднимается, уходит в море.
Зачастую вот экологические все лозунги и экологические мероприятия, они глобально ни на что не влияют. Вот они просто создают видимость движухи. Но глобально человечество как переводило со все увеличивающейся скоростью ресурсы, так и переводит. То есть, ну, тут как бы подход нужно менять.
Какое-то место силы тянет сюда просто. Вот. Очень многие люди, которые здесь раз побывали, потом приезжают снова и снова. Вроде бы разруха, вроде как бы так грустно смотреть, а что-то вот такое в нем есть.
Такая натуральная, чистая Арктика, как она и должна быть в наших глазах.
Чистить Арктику – это не просто какие-то слова, знаете, там какие-то лозунги или что-то еще. Для меня это настоящая судьба.
Это смысл всей моей жизни.
Schultz is not that bright, and he is an even worse German chancellor. Though he is self-aware enough to understand and acknowledge some nations see double standards on Russia. Neocolonial thinking, it would seem, dies hard.
We are back with Carly Matthews from the American Conservation Coalition on climate lockdown. Carly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scotty.
Okay, so we are hearing about ESG, or environmental, social, and governance. Now, this is an investing strategy looking at a business's environmental and social risk, all a part of financial planning. So does ESG investing actually make a difference? And do you see companies really beholden to a higher standard now? Or does the entire system still lack proper checks, verifications, and most importantly, accountability?
It's a great question. I think ESG is something that is well-intentioned. I think it's capitalism working. I think it's businesses investing in what they think is right, which as a conservative, I think is good business practice. But I think that you're right, that there is kind of this element of, well, if they're not investing in ESG, then they're, you know, not the right type of company, or, you know, they're not prioritizing social justice enough. Whereas I think a lot of these companies do ESG investing for kind of PR and public image. So it's an interesting balance of seeing, you know, which companies are really taking their values into account and are investing in initiatives that they really believe in and making a difference versus, you know, running a PR campaign.
Sticking to finances, you know, most of the Western world actually lives as a capitalist society. So why don't they let the paying customer decide? You know, if the company wants to go green, if it wants to lower its own carbon footprint, and people are into that, let it succeed. If they don't care about the planet and people don't want their product pushed any product anymore, the company will fail. Why does the government have to actually get involved? Why not just leave it up to the consumer?
Absolutely. And that's something we talk a lot about at ACC, kind of this idea of voting with your dollars and supporting companies that share your values. I think that the intention of ESG is to do that, right? For companies to kind of show their values, put their money where their mouth is, and for consumers to accept or reject that, support that company or not support that company. I think that in itself is capitalist. I think that is the free market working. But I think that the government mandating that businesses invest this way is the wrong path forward. And we should really make sure that the government is out of investing and let companies like Microsoft, like Apple, like these large companies that have the capital to do so. I think that they should be able to invest in initiatives that their employees believe in.
Well, it's interesting when you're talking about conservation, it seems like there's very extreme polarized ends where you're either very much this way, they're very much this side. But yet, is there some middle ground? For instance, let's say littering in Cincelli's is such a high fine. It is one of the most pristine beaches that I've ever seen. It is a fact that littering is bad for the environment. It's also just bad for you as a person to do. While the best types of energy seem to be up for debate, how can we actually protect the planet for future generations without actually making the government regulate every aspect of our lives?
Right, and I really like that you brought up littering because that's really kind of the perfect example of protecting our planet and just kind of an individual action that we've accepted is bad. We shouldn't litter. And there are fines for that. There's also kind of like a social aspect of like if a friend sees you littering, that friend is going to think about you differently. So I think that's a really good example of kind of an individual action to help protect the planet. With energy, of course, it's more complicated. Yes, fossil fuels produce emissions, but they're also the reason that our society has advanced to the level it has today. So there are trade-offs there. That's why we advocate for an all-of-the-above energy approach and recognize that different areas of the country are going to be able to get their energy from different sources and what works in Washington State, like hydropower, isn't going to work in Florida, where they really thrive off solar power. So I think that there's a discussion to be had there, that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution for all energy and climate issues. And especially in a country as kind of vast and geographically diverse as ours, we're going to need kind of a patchwork of solutions. And that's why my organization advocates for a climate commitment, which lays out kind of a variety of policy pathways that we can pursue in order to lower our emissions, but also protect the planet with people in mind.
And yet you're finding right now, I think around the world, people are trying to figure out where they're going to get their energy from at this point and hope that there's enough of it there. You're right, the fact that one part of the region, you cannot put rules across the entire globe. Obviously, the climate is different in various areas. Let's take China, where there are restrictions on what day you can drive in order to limit the number of people that are actually on the road due to their exploding population, plus in order to lower pollution that's happening. At any given time, Shanghai is covered in a cloud of pollution as the air quality levels are over twice the World Health Organization's recommended safety threshold. There's got to be an effect on health from that. So could this be something other countries look to, and for once actually the West get it right, implement in the future? But is it hard to make it as one big global umbrella policy that would work for all?
Right. I don't think that one size fits all silver bullet solution exists. And I think we see that when we look to the UN. I mean, name a more dysfunctional body than the UN. And, you know, treaties that we see come out of the UN, they're non-binding, right? There's not a way that we can hold other countries like China accountable. And China is really kind of the driver of climate change as we see it today. They're not planning to start reducing emissions until 2030. That's when their emissions will peak. And so I think when we're talking about China and the way that they've treated the environment, They don't care about climate change. They care about power. The CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, you know, all they care about is kind of their position on the world stage. And in the United States, in our ally countries, we really care about our people and our planet, and we have to ensure that the solutions that we implement on our soil work for both of those. And I don't think that China is really an example that we should look to, frankly, for anything, but especially on the environment.
So we've talked a lot about climate limitations, but has any country actually implemented a climate lockdown? And do you think it was a model for others wanting to do the same?
I do not know of a quote-unquote successful climate lockdown anywhere on the planet. And frankly, I don't think there would be one. I think that the closest thing we can find is kind of restrictions in China as far as driving, things like that. But again, I don't think that that's something that Western countries are really going to tolerate.
Once again, it's one of those things that you're kind of just threatening out there as almost a fear factor on. I don't know if it necessarily helps in receiving your message right now to actually care more about the climate when you have those kind of threats out there. There has been, though, a lot of criticism of climate activists lately. You mentioned it earlier. You know, for example, you have patently staged arrest of Greta Thunberg. And people might think that she's really helped the climate change effort argument. I think she's actually done a lot of damage. It's definitely destroyed a lot of the trust that some have in it all over the past months. You've even had her deleting a tweet where she herself said the Earth would be destroyed by climate change in 2023. And obviously, we're having this conversation right now. Her prediction did not come true. Lots of celebrities and elites who fly on private jets around the world to events where they turn around and they preach about and receive awards about their climate change activists. They're telling us what we should do. Obviously, they're not. Don't you think this actually plays onto this negative perception the average citizen has of any climate activism and perhaps actually strips away what might be at the core a sincere message of warning to take care of our own planet?
I think you're exactly right. That's a big reason that my organization does not engage in protests. You will never find us gluing ourselves to walls or getting arrested for protesting. I think that when we're talking about climate activism, we have to think about, you know, how you're going to win people over to your side. And I don't think you're going to do that by interrupting their commute, by blocking traffic, destroying a priceless piece of artwork, or staging an arrest. So I think when we're really trying to reach new audiences, emphasize the importance of protecting our planet, we have to get serious about the tactics that we use to do that. And performative activism, frankly, doesn't work. And even the Extinction Rebellion, which is kind of you know, the most notorious climate activism group in Europe, announced earlier this year that they would be laying off of some of these protests because they found anecdotally that they do not work. So I think that we're really seeing kind of a change in that and seeing that, you know, we kind of need to we need to show people why they should care rather than kind of throwing a stunt in their face.
Thank you so much, Carly Matthews, Communication Director at the American Conservation Coalition. Now, while the world was quick to submit to lockdowns out of fear of a virus, I think it's going to take a lot more convincing for the same to happen over an occurrence which is still highly debated as whether it is man-made or just the natural progression of the Earth. Sadly, as with almost every other controversial topic, when those who make the rules actually abide by them, then maybe any restrictions they offer will be taken seriously. I'm Sky Nell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.